Hello everyone and welcome to Don't Ignore the Elephant, the podcast where we talk about the stuff that no one else will, the elephant in the room. I'm Liz O'Riordan. I'm a breast cancer surgeon with breast cancer myself, and during my career I've had a lot of elephants to deal with. I've learned that talking about them, getting them out in the open, can help you know that you're not alone. And it's wonderful that we're building a community of people who want to talk about their elephants. Keep sharing them with me, because together we can help each other. Whether it's cancer, grief, resilience or bullying, losing your identity, or simply how to get out of bed in the morning, there are loads of things that can be hard to discuss. I know how powerful it can be to hear someone else talk honestly about their own problems. I've carefully chosen my guests to help get these issues on the table. They've either experienced the elephant themselves or spent their life helping those of us who have them. I'm going to be asking the questions everyone else is too afraid to ask. In this episode, I'm getting really personal by talking about therapy. What is it? When do you need it? And why I had it. This week's guest is Maggie Hope. She's a senior accredited psychotherapist, counsellor and trainer for psychotherapists in the future. And she's joining me today to talk about therapy. What is it? Who needs it? Are the American TV shows accurate, or is it something completely different? And I think there are so many emotions around having or needing therapy. I found it hard to tell people. I felt guilty or privileged or embarrassed that I needed it. And I can't wait to share Maggie's expert insight with you all and put some myths to bed. So welcome, Maggie, to Don't Ignore the Elephant.
Hello, Liz. Thank you very much for having me to talk about this. And I think how you started this and the sentiments that you've mentioned are really pertinent more than ever at the moment, with more and more people seeking therapy, dare I say post-pandemic, when it took many of us into places that we hadn't been in before, perhaps, and kind of altered how we viewed ourselves and how we belong and what that brought up. So yes, I'm very happy to join you today.
And I think it's really interesting. At school, you're kind of aware of medical health and you learn about heart attacks and kind of physical things that happen, but no one really tells you about how to cope with your mental health. And it's often only once you become an adult and you start having all these responsibilities, you think, I'm not actually trained for this. So let's start by asking really simply, what is therapy?
Essentially, it's two people in a room. And when you started today and you said, oh, and Maggie is an expert, actually, I would flip that and say that truthfully, the client is the expert on themselves. And yet I think there's something within us all that is at times obscured. So I would like to say that perhaps it's two people at the beginning of a journey, and we both arrive at that destination, perhaps with a rucksack. But let's say that you're the client for the moment. Your rucksack is very heavy.
Yeah.
And it's got lots of places or pockets that you don't choose to look in anymore. So my rucksack perhaps has some skills, some training, let's hope, and all of those things, and some resources. And between the two of us, we're going to develop how to let go of some of your material that perhaps you've been carrying for a long, long time, maybe decades, maybe your entire life. And we're going to develop a map that's going to cover the terrain. And sometimes that terrain is going to be quite difficult, because a therapeutic journey, even if it's just 6 weeks or 6 years, can be hard.
Yeah.
It's because you're going to share parts of yourself with me that you may never have shed with anyone else. So that's kind of the answer that I would say to a client. It's you and I, here we are. Yeah. We have to take the first step. There are some parameters to this, of course, but let's take that first step and let's be courageous together, because it's a two-way journey.
Yeah.
Not just your journey, it's ours together. It's a shared relationship.
And that really resonates with me. So I first had therapy when I was off work with suicidal depression. The stress of being a consultant cancer surgeon was just too much. And I went to therapy and I assumed that the therapist would fix me, because you kind of, they're the doctor. And actually, no, they're not. I'm doing the fixing.
Yeah.
And they are guiding me to work through my own problems so I can cope. But it was a real, oh, I need to do some work here. And it is that two-way street of letting someone help you and let you in, I think.
Yeah, it's that sense of perhaps reaching a point. And I think one of the questions that comes up is, how do I know when is the moment that I'm going to put down this rucksack? You know, what are the sort of symptoms, whether it's just a lack of tolerance,
yeah,
the beginning of being unkind to myself or to others, perhaps the sense of relying on things that I've always relied on and suddenly they're not there anymore. And all those sort of stresses that are so much part of being human, if we have the resilience. When the resilience starts to slip away, that'd be an extremely scary place, especially if you felt extremely competent, as you do in your career.
I think it's really hard to know how bad do you need to be before you seek therapy. And I know in my place, I was at a very, very low point. I was in denial. And actually before that, I drank an awful lot of medical school and a friend had to say, I think you might need some help. And when you're hearing it and you think you're fine, how do you know you need it? When is the right time?
Well, I would say that perhaps I would contradict myself, that maybe it's not always when that rucksack feels heavy, when you feel overwhelmed, you lack resilience, the robustness that you've come to rely on suddenly begins to diminish. I would say that almost anyone would benefit from therapy, but maybe I would say that, wouldn't I?
But no, I think you're right. I think you almost want it before the shit hits the fan, before you hit rock bottom, so you never go that low. And I think a lot of us, there's a stigma of saying, I need therapy, I need help. What are people going to think if I need it?
Yeah, and yet I can recall as a child really trying to make sense of my life, even as a small child. And I think that if we were to look at children, if there were some children sitting around us, occasionally one would stare off into the middle distance. In our family, we call that, oh, he's got the stares. But when you look at very small children, they really do stare into this middle distance. They're trying to make sense of this very complex world that we live in. And I can recall thinking about, oh, what is it to be alone? What is it to be with friends or without friends? Wow. That sense of, how do I belong in the world? You know, what's the point? And these rather existential questions, if you like, I think are worth examining even at a young age. There is a philosophy that goes alongside therapy that even small children can understand.
Yeah.
Elements, you mentioned that you had sort of suicide ideation. You felt as if the balance or the equilibrium of your life had changed. And I liken that to the sort of very Freudian response of the death drive or the drive for libido, if you like, that I always explain it that there's two walls and that as long as our arms are sort of outstretched, we can touch both walls in balance. But occasionally we step closer to another wall and we begin to think about what would it be like not to be alive because everything feels so overwhelming. But I truly believe that even as a small child watching a worm kind of traverse the pavement thinks, oh, should I help that worm get to the other side? Or should I, or what will happen if I don't? And then conversely, that is death, the first thoughts we have of what it's like not to be here. So I'm not always so sure that it's the province of those who feel they're suffering more that perhaps we live in a certain sort of sufferance all the time, but we are able to cope with it.
Or we think we're coping.
Or we think we cope. I don't like that word cope, but...
No, it's awful, isn't it?
You
live because you have to, and you often don't realise that there is help available. It's just learning to reach out for it.
It's trying to let go of that stigma, perhaps, of help, you know.
It doesn't mean you're broken or that you're bad at your job or that you can't cope. And before I got cancer, I felt guilty that I needed therapy for having depression when there were so many other people struggling. And it's, you have to almost stop comparing your life with other people's, don't you?
Yes. The best place, I think, to go in comparison is to compare yourself to yourself, if you like. To say, well, this is how I was 6 months ago, or this is even how I was 6 weeks ago before this event happened, before this diagnosis.
Yeah.
And this is how I am now. And It's not about saying, well, oh, this person's amazing. They've been through this, that, and whatever, and they've come out on top. Because we're all very different and unique, and our ability to get through things or to get through the stresses of life is very different.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, when you talked about suddenly thinking it's somebody else saying to you, I think you need therapy, and that sudden feeling of, gosh, do I? What's that about? Even though you're in a profession that's kind of based on offering that advice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think a lot of professional people, especially those in the caring professions, you don't get counselling to help you cope with the trauma you see on a daily basis. Whether it's children dying in A&E or it's breaking bad news, whatever it is, it's part of the job. And again, that massive burnout that happened in the pandemic, you kind of realise we are human. Whatever you see in your job, you have to deal with all these stresses, and there is so little support for professionals dealing with this day in, day out. And I almost think CBT or therapy should be part of anyone who has a stressful job, just to help them cope or to debrief.
Yes, and certainly I think there is a move now, much needed, for those in the front line of anything to be able to access that support, to be able to say at the end of the day, can I check in here with someone who is not on the wards and not at the front line, but someone who will understand and walk alongside you for a while? It's very important that it's the police force, again, or any of the emergency services, see some pretty horrific things, sometimes on a daily basis. And the soul can only bear so much before that the graphicness of it begins to become intrusive or to find its way into our very unconscious place. And then we start to have these thoughts that are difficult to share, the sort of the shadowy parts of ourselves.
Yeah.
I think that there's some stigma to that, to be able to say, well, I have these thoughts.
Yeah, I think it's huge. So I'm having bereavement counselling at the minute. My mum died. And it's being able to tell someone who's anonymous, and I can tell them the scary thoughts deep inside my soul, and I don't need to worry about them looking after themselves when I leave the room. Because often when you share those feelings with someone you love, you worry about how they're going to feel and how they're going to react. And for me, it's having that complete stranger who is just there to look after me.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's so important, I think. Although I might say that perhaps in the more deeper therapeutic relationships, as they have that longevity, that there is a certain, perhaps at times, internalization for the client, starts to internalize the therapist. It's a very important part of the therapeutic work. And perhaps at times might be able to take care of the therapist a little bit, which is very controversial. And that could be okay too. Can I bear to take care of you, knowing that in a way you might not need that? And it's a story that I often say to my students of the therapist who decides to see the clients for the day, even though she has a slight cold.
Yeah.
Client number one walks in and she says, oh, I'm sorry, I have a slight cold today. And the client says, oh, well, I don't see why I should be paying you all this money if you're not fit for the job, you know, if you can't listen to me. And then the next client comes along and she says, oh, just to let you know, I have a slight cold today. And the next client says, oh, are you okay?
Yeah.
And suddenly we see the difference in the maturity of that relationship. And also perhaps what might have happened to that client when they were a child and the response that they got. So, I mean, a lot of therapy, as you probably know, it's not so much in the here and now.
No.
It takes you right back to the there and then, the historical sense of ourselves that felt cared for, or conversely didn't feel cared for at all.
Yeah.
So that early trauma. And it's interesting that early trauma often leads us to become caretakers in the caring professions. We become the wounded carers, if you like, the wounded foot soldiers, when we already have our own material, which will no doubt be evoked again and again and again. So that's why I always believe training is so important in therapy, to be able to hold on to some of this material, which can feel really very hard to heal at times.
Yeah, it must do. One thing I didn't realize was how battered I would feel after therapy. You'd go in expecting to talk about something, and I think, as you said, other things will come up, and I wasn't prepared the first time to get back in the car and thinking, oh my goodness, I can't do anything for the next couple of hours. That feeling of just unburdening yourself and that emotional impact it can have.
And kind of leaving it there. It's a strange thing, isn't it, that I always think that, you know, you're going for 1 hour a week. Maybe if you're in psychoanalysis and you're going 3 hours a week, but you're going for that 1 hour, just 1 hour, 60 minutes. I mean, you and I, our contact will only be for 60 minutes. And yet, I thought a lot about what it would be to meet you and have this meeting. I didn't know you. So I was already in a relationship, even though we hadn't met. And no doubt later on today, I'll be still thinking about it. And I don't know if we'll ever meet again. But nevertheless, in therapy, the hour is very important, very intimate. But the therapy goes on, doesn't it? Start to dream about your therapist, or have all these thoughts around your therapist, this curious relationship that is not friendship.
No.
It's a kinship, if you like, maybe, or a companion on the journey. But you won't know a great deal about your therapist, but your therapist will know a great deal about you.
Yeah, it's quite an unbalanced relationship, isn't it? Because you're the one talking. To listeners who are people tuning in, who feel they're in a hard place, they feel they need someone to talk to, how do you know what therapy you need? Where do you go to know that someone you, what kind of therapy you need, and is the person you're seeing the right person for you?
There are thousands of therapists out there.
I know.
Thousands of us. I would say the first thing to do, since you're on Google already, is to go to the main providers of therapy. That's the BACP, British Association of Counselling and Psychotherapy, or the UKCP, the United Kingdom Council of Psychotherapy. They're the big providers. They have registration. It's so important. You see a counsellor who is registered, trained, and so on and so forth. Then it gets more complicated. I mean, you could go to your GP, of course. They can put you towards a psychological service. Then it becomes more complicated, because then you've got to think, well, how much can I afford? Therapy at the top end is hugely expensive, hugely expensive. And at the other end, inexpensive, but you might not be seeing someone who's as qualified, which seems always to me vastly unfair. But putting that aside for a moment, essentially, therapy falls into three main brackets, so to speak. The first one is the kind of relational therapy, if you like, or psychodynamic therapy, where you will be taking material from your childhood, more than likely, and would be expected to come for longer, maybe a year.
Yeah.
I've had some of my clients for 15 years, so maybe a long time, could be a long journey. Then we have the cognitive behavioral therapy. So maybe that is perhaps something that you recognize in yourself that is inhibiting you from your daily activities of living. It could be quite sudden. You fall off a bicycle, it becomes very shocking for you, and you think, I've suddenly become scared of getting on the bus.
Yeah.
Or I found a spider all of a sudden in my bedroom and now I'm frightened. You know, those kind of things that happen very acutely and yet suddenly feel very debilitating. Then perhaps we have the analytical, which is the sort of the Freudian analysis. And then you're kind of counseling that perhaps is something a bit more related to having something acute happening that hasn't taken you to a phobic place, but perhaps is a place of loss. You lost your job. Your relationship has suddenly become unstuck, a miscarriage, these kind of things. So you might be thinking, I'm having counselling just for 6 months, just to put me back on track. sometimes the getting back on track therapy actually means going back in time, because yeah. this isn't the first time you've come unstuck. This isn't the first relationship that seems to have cancelled itself out in this way. So I think to answer the second part of your question, go and sit in front of that person. Yeah, don't be worried if you don't like them. You don't like the smell of their house.
It's a bit like in a hairdresser's, and you get a really, and I'm awful with my glasses. I look fabulous. I put my glasses on. I hate it, but no, thank you very much. It's lovely. Here's my credit card. You can try therapists on for size.
Absolutely, you can. Absolutely. And choose. Maybe you feel particularly you'd like to work with a woman. Perhaps you'd like to work with a man. Perhaps there are issues of gender. You'd like to work with someone who can understand some dysmorphia. Perhaps it's something to do with an eating disorder. So you need a specialist. Most therapists are able to say quite clearly, I'm not sure I'm the right person for you.
Yeah. If they treat everything, you've got to worry, haven't you? They specialize in everything.
Yes. I mean, there's a directory, counseling directory, and at the bottom, each therapist, they can tick a box. And sometimes all boxes are ticked. And I think, well, that's great. You must be an expert in every field. But I kind of think, how can you be?
Yeah. But like in medicine, we used to have general surgeons who did everything and actually realized you get better results when people do specialize and focus. And I think it's remembering, God, I hate Google. Just because someone has a really flashy or singing or dancing website doesn't mean they are the best person for you.
No, absolutely not. And, you know, like I say, cost, getting to therapy with your therapist, perhaps see you online sometimes if you can't make it. How accommodating are they? And really, Liz, I would say is, do you like them?
Yeah.
Do you like this therapist? Could you bear it? I mean, you don't have to like your therapist to be in therapist, but it helps that there's some commonality, that you like their practice, that when you sit down for the first time, they might say, take a look around. What draws your attention? Do you like that artwork? Take a risk. Maybe you don't like it, you know?
I love that. That you have to like that person to want to share the deepest, darkest aspects of your personality. And it's great for people to know that you can get a second opinion. You can try someone else.
Keep trying. Because there are some therapists out there that have a certain way of working that really might not suit you at all. Or... Yeah. Their flashy website, but actually they're working in a very busy shared household, or you didn't know that they had a cat and you have a cat allergy, or all of these things. And yeah, they may ask odd questions. So walk away, you know, if you can, walk away. So, well, I felt uncomfortable. If you can, which is very difficult when you feel distressed.
So let's talk about what to expect in a therapy session, because we kind of, my first image of therapy was American TV shows, and you lie on the couch and where do you go? And I remember going in thinking there are two chairs. I don't know which one to sit in. Am I being judged the minute I walk in? And should I put my coat on the floor? I talk a lot. And as a doctor, I talk too much. It's really hard to sit and have that uncomfortable silence. And it was that feeling of, I need to talk constantly. I can't just be quiet and be. We have all these expectations of how we should behave to be the perfect therapy patient. Can you put me right, please?
Well, okay, what happens? So all therapists need to have some sort of contract. You need to be able to know what you're getting, I think. And that's so important. And it might be about what you're going to pay. What happens if you miss a session? Do you have to pay for that session? Could you reschedule? What happens when your therapist goes on holiday? What happens when you go on therapy on holiday? Will you still be expected to pay even though you're not there? All of these things are to be noted. So I think if you haven't received that information should be coming your way in the first session. Some therapists don't work with a contract. That's their choice. But nevertheless, they should be able to verbalize what you're getting.
Yeah.
And the kind of the terms of the agreement. And in therapy speak, we call this the working alliance, which essentially means the tasks of therapy. What are we going to do? And the second part of that is the goal, to be asked, what are you coming to therapy for exactly? And don't be surprised if your therapist either does write some notes in this first session, because you know, we're not mind readers. We might be a little nervous ourselves either. This is a first encounter.
Yeah.
Sometimes therapists remember everything. And the last bit is the bond part. This is to do with your attachment. You know, and the therapist may say, well, how are you feeling here with me?
Mm.
You feel comfortable? Is there anything you want to ask me? Because you are the customer, so you have the right to say, well, I wonder how long have you been trained and will you be talking to me about anybody else? And the therapist should say, yes, I will. I will be talking to a supervisor about our relationship. And that should be really clear. In terms of the room, I think, yes, I can imagine, you know, if there's two chairs, I often have got, where shall I sit? So truthfully, you can sit wherever you like.
But that's so stressful because you think, oh, but if I sit here, they'll think that. And if I sit there, they'll think that. I'm overreading it, but it's...
What if the therapist would say, wow, that choice that I'm giving you is really part of how I work. I'm here to find out how you make choices. And I'm here to check out how empowered you are in those choices.
I can feel my stress levels rising already.
Oh, I would say, but for sure, listen, let me take that away from you right now. You sit there, I'm going to sit here. But over the next few weeks, you might want to work on the floor. You might want to sit in my chair. For sure, I'll sit where you're sitting. It's fine. Some therapists are very welded to their chair. I remember seeing my therapist in a supermarket once and thinking, where's the chair? Where's the chair? You know, I didn't even know he had arms and legs. Where's the chair? Should I shake my therapist's hand?
Oh, yes.
As a rule, no, if it helps. And relax, should I take my shoes off? You know, for some clients, it's a cultural thing as well to take your shoes off in someone else's house. And that perhaps... it's important for you. So I think therapy is all about trying in those first few sessions to make the client feel as comfortable to unpack their rucksack little by little. And I always say, I don't have an all-access pass here. I don't have permission to walk into your landscape. Okay, so if you feel me pushing, you can say stop. It's okay. You can say stop. I don't feel comfortable. And I'll say, okay, no worries. That's, I think, really one of the most important thing is that attachment. And of course, you know, historically, if a client has difficulties with attachment, they might not know it, or they might have an inkling that in relationships become distressing in terms of how I form attachments, then that's going to be one of the first things that comes up.
Yeah.
How am I going to sit with this person I don't know and find some way of attaching to them? And and actually I might begin to miss them a bit between sessions. And can that be okay? Where I'm falling in love. Or I'm falling in lust.
Now, it doesn't just happen to doctors then, it happens to therapists too.
Absolutely. So in some respects, when you see the American counsellors, that often comes up, the kind of erotic transference.
Yes.
The sense of this therapist becoming kind of a love object for me.
Because they're listening to you. You have a captive audience of someone who listens to you and who cares for you and is attentive.
And therefore that can verge into sexual feelings, erotic feelings. Yeah. And that's okay too. So clearly a good therapist is going to bring that into the room in a skillful way and make it okay. Because often it's the parts of our development that we missed out on come into the room. That needy young part of us that so needs to be held, contained, literally maybe physically held. And that's a big question that comes up. Will the counsellor hold me? What happens if I cry? You know, these things are questions that often may stop people. Will she give me a tissue? Should I bring my own tissue? Will she hold me if I'm very distressed? You know, or will he? And what will that mean for me? Can I surrender myself sufficiently to allow that to happen? But what was your experience? Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, no. So I had CBT when I was off work, having had suicidal thoughts. And it was very much, I'm a doctor, I'm thinking like a doctor, they're going to be judging me where I sit. And I think I know what they're going to ask me. So I think I should tell them what they want to hear. And then I thought, I'm going to go in talking about X. And I started talking about B and Z and G. And I thought, wow, where did that come from? It was just having that space just to talk and probably finally be actually open and honest about things I'd been hiding. And slowly, painfully work through tiny little steps at a time to rebuild myself. I think one of the things I found when I had therapy for depression was, you're off sick, but you're being told to go and enjoy yourself and smile and go to the park. I think, but if people see me happy, they'll think I should be at work. And it was slowly realizing how to learn to look after myself and how to put in, do the work I've knew I needed to do for a long, long time. I just didn't want to do it. And I resented the therapist telling me to do it. And I knew she was right. It's like, oh, don't tell me. I know, I'm sorry. But how you work through that, whereas I'm having bereavement counseling at the minute for mum dying, and I felt guilty that I needed it because I'm a doctor. I've looked after people who've died. Is it too soon? What was grief normally like? And to be in a room and just suddenly find myself in floods of tears, and it was a safe space to do it. And I could just sit and be and feel, and that sense of release, this is somewhere safe I can go. And then I can practice feeling that emotion outside of the room because it is going to carry on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can relate to that feeling when my own mother died of kind of the deep sense of orphanage, if you like.
Yes, completely.
The unbearable. And I, you know, my mother died several years ago, but I can still recall the real sense of injustice.
Yeah.
That the lack of preparation for this time in my life, you know, and my own daughter now, who's in her 30s, sort of says, well, you know, I don't want you to die, mummy. But of course, you know,
we all die.
And perhaps that snail I was talking about earlier in some way prepares us for that eventuality.
Yeah.
If our own parents are able to freely talk about this. But in our society, we don't tend to talk a lot about death. We talk a lot about other stuff, you know, what it is to be alive, how to live. But we don't really talk about how to live when we are in the process of dying or being around others that die. And I think for me, this first instance of complete reshaping of meaning and reshaping of who I am, or reframing, if you like. And maybe... Yeah. Underneath all of what we present as clients, underneath it all is loss. Take it all away. It's the loss of meaning or loss of belonging, loss of faith, loss of culture, loss of youth, and all of these things. But it's lost deep down.
It is, isn't it?
We really struggle. You know, I can desperately recognize in a way, you know, if I know the why of my life, I think this is Nietzsche that said this, I can bear the how. If I knew really what life was about, and honestly, Liz, I don't really know, thank goodness, what death is about.
No.
Not truthfully, because none of us do. You know, it's a kind of a complete blessing for me therapeutically to be able to say, I don't know.
Yeah.
I only know that I am not a stranger to you in this moment because I feel that too. You may not know these details of my life, client of mine. You won't know, you know, when my mother died or what my dog is called or where I'm going on holiday. You might not know all of those details, but for sure you will know the landscape of my feelings because I will share those with you. So that we can be humans together, and hopefully you will feel less lost in this moment.
Yeah. I think that's it. It's knowing you're not alone.
Yeah, absolutely.
You have therapy and you bare your soul and you may be telling the therapist things that you haven't told your family or loved ones. When you come out, should you share that with your family? Should you keep it private? Is there a therapist patient ideal? Should you talk about what you talked about in the room with other people?
I would have thought that's entirely up to you. However, I think family may not entirely understand. And what may happen is you have therapy and those that are close to you say, oh, you've really changed since you've had therapy. And that can feel quite damning, in fact, I think. you know, when one person of a family goes in for therapy, they sometimes can leave the others behind.
I think when I had cancer, my husband couldn't understand what I was going through because he hadn't had cancer. It was hard to explain. And I could feel the, not isolation, but it's like he felt left out, that he couldn't share it with me. And I felt, you cannot understand where I am because you, thank God, haven't been in my shoes.
Yes. And you're making a really good point there, that perhaps families and friends need a basic explanation, and to a certain extent that may be a relief.
Yeah.
Because friends, you know, family obviously do so much want to help. And I recall a client of mine saying, you know, I feel as if I want to keep this not secret, but I want to keep this just between me and you, because I don't yeah. want to have to take all this out, because I feel when I take this material out, it won't be deeply understood. Is that okay? You know, is that okay?
I guess often Chinese whispers, when you relay what's been said, you're not getting the exact language or the tone right, and things can lose meaning. And I think it's okay, people listening, if therapy is just a private space for the two of you. But let's talk about, if you have had therapy, at some point you have to say goodbye, or people who can't afford it, or the waiting list to get therapy on the NHS is just too long. Do you have things that can help us try to develop resilience, whatever that is?
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to the NHS for therapy, expect 6 to 12 sessions. So it's going to be a very short journey indeed. And then before you get to the end of the third or fourth session, you're going to be heading towards an ending. You might have an opportunity to have another 6 sessions, maybe, maybe not. The luxury of open-ended therapy, completely different, that you can come and see me for 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. Nevertheless, every step that we take in that journey is one step closer to the end. And so I think that, remember I was talking about that rucksack and how we're both going to have rucksacks, and I'm going to, with your permission, put some things in your rucksack, or you're going to develop some tools for yourself. You'll be able to put down some of these burdens that you've been carrying. We're going to pack up your rucksack so that towards the end of therapy, we're going to say, so, let's look at this journey. Let's look at the tools and the resources that you have. It was Stephen Covey, who's the wonderful author of 7 Successful Habits.
Oh, yes.
Yes. His, one of his habits is called sharpen the saw. It's specifically used in families, and it doesn't mean, you know, sharpen the saw, but it means keep practicing these habits. Keep practicing your self-care. Believe in your self-worth. Utilize what you've learned in therapy. Keep a journal.
Yeah.
You know, and remember that for most therapists, you can come back. You can come back. The door is ajar. You know, I'm still there in my chair. You know, so I think it's about practicing what you've learned, really, and being given an opportunity to practice.
And what is self-care? What, from a therapist's point of view, would self-care be like for a client?
I think self-care is possible if you as a child were cared for. Therefore, you have that already instilled, internalized, a self-esteem and self-worth. Babies born as the perfect machine, omnipotently so, able to generate their own self-esteem. Look at any baby. They know they've only got to squawk and people come running. Look at any toddler. Yes. The reality is that perfect machine, that well-oiled machine, begins to get tiny pieces of grit in it. This is our parents' conditional regard for us rather than an unconditional, our parents' lack of acceptance, our parents' lack of kindness, warmth, or empathy to a certain extent, grits up the machine. And therefore, as adults, we do have a fairly gritty machine. It doesn't work as well. Therapy, in a way, ungrits the machine sufficiently so that we don't have to go externally from ourselves and get our needs met all over the place, meeting our own needs. Yes. Yeah? So self-care for me, it's a very well-used phrase now, isn't it? Self-care.
It is.
But maybe it is about being able to say, well, do I feel safe psychologically, physically, emotionally, spiritually, check, check, check. Do I have a sense of belonging? Am I able then to perhaps find beauty beyond myself?
Yeah.
Aesthetically, going to the park, looking at nature, being part of, and then finally, perhaps into a more altruistic space by caring for others and receiving care back. It's a tall ask, isn't it? If the very bottom layer of that, our very physical well-being, feels unsafe. If we don't have enough money, self-care, going to the park doesn't really help, does it? But yeah, for me, self-care perhaps is really about how can I care for myself.
I've never heard it described like that, that self-worth, self-care. It's all internal. Your values, are you safe? Often it's, you know, go and have a glass of wine or paint your nails red, that kind of the superficial coverings to make you feel good for a small amount of time, rather than focusing on, do you feel safe? Do you belong? What is important to you?
Yeah, belonging is so important to human beings, isn't it?
Yeah. And which brings me on to social media.
Oh.
I know, because you're not on it, are you?
Very rarely.
It's weird. I kind of think social media is my job because by doing videos and talking, it helps my books get sold. And it's a way of me helping people. I guess getting my ego stroked. No, I'm no longer a doctor. I can't treat patients, but I can work this way. But it sucks so many hours out of my day.
Yes.
And it's such a draining thing. I'm helping all these people, getting nothing really back. Is it worth it? Do you do it? You can get... And it's really interesting how it's changed my life and so many other people's lives.
Social media. Yes. Well, I mean, it's on the rise, or certainly working online is on the rise. I can know many therapists now who used to work face to face, now only work online.
Yeah.
It's a difficult one, isn't it? Because even for you and I don't know what you smell like. I'm sure you smell lovely, but I don't know what you look like from the neck downwards. I can't quite, with that little microsecond delay, I can't always read you.
And that's you seeing me in video. But when you take that to social media, you don't see people at all. You just merely see what they write.
Yeah, that's a complete veneer, isn't it, of an external, what I call an external locus. It's not entirely real. And even though I know social media has aspects that are very good because it does actually create some commonality for people who need that commonality with addiction or dysmorphia or any of the other stuff that goes on. Mm. It's good to know that there is someone else out there who feels the same way. So in that respect, yes, but I find it very destructive. And, you know, here I am on my laptop. I have my phone just sitting here.
Yes, I know.
You know,
and again, back in that shallow world, it's like, well, how do I need to find a doctor? Well, they don't have a presence on YouTube or Twitter or Instagram, so they must be bad. I'm going to go to people on there. And it's just, it's how it's changed our experience of everything. And I think part of me for therapy was learning to put my phone down and have screen-free Sundays and nights and get the phones out of the bedroom and just connect. I used to tweet my husband, who'd be sat on the sofa next to me, to send him a message. That's how bad we get.
But in that kind of what I call the sort of back-to-back relationship, where actually the couples are in the same room, but they're not actually facing each other. One's looking at a laptop, the other one's on the scrolling on the phone. You can be extremely destructive. And I know, as I have a husband who's always on social media, I can't get him off it. This Friday, when we're going to go out for a long walk, it's going to have to be phone free. And he said, like, what if we have an accident? What if something happens? Well, then something will happen, you know. But yeah, I feel it's got a lot to answer for in terms of human contact, you know, and getting to deeply understand another human being. And I feel filled with fear when I see those small babies look up at mothers who are on their phone.
They know. Even my dog knows that the phone is more important than him at times, because mummy's always looking at it.
Yeah, because mummies and daddies, we have a different expression when we have what I call a kind of a blunt effect. You know, when I'm on my phone, I'm just, my jaw's dropping and I'm scrolling away. I'm not animated in the same way.
No.
And I think it's so important for children. I'm not sure what's going to happen with that. But in therapeutic terms, for us as therapists, it's useful to be able to stay in contact with clients at times through a phone. And it's useful.
It's how you work with it in a safe manner, isn't it? Now, I could talk and talk to you for hours, Maggie, and thank you so much. But before we go, I've got one last question.
Yes.
We have a jar of joy for the podcast, where listeners send in comments of things that have made them smile and they go in the jar of joy. And I want to ask you, what one thing has made you smile in the last couple of days?
Oh, how wonderful. What's made me smile? I couldn't think. Lots of stuff has made me smile. I was walking on the street and there was a lemon tree that overhangs. And I picked a lemon and I brought it home and I cut it open. And the smell was incredible. And
yeah,
for me, that's what I might call a complete gestalt, to introduce another word, the idea that from tree to hand to mouth, that sense of humanness that I miss out on so much.
Wow. It's the simple things, it really is, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. That is definitely going in the jar. Thank you so much, Maggie, for talking us today.
And thank you so much for having me. And I think, yes, we probably kept going.
And that brings us to the end of this episode of Don't Ignore the Elephant. I don't know about you, but I've really struggled with the fact that I needed therapy in the past. I didn't want to admit to people that I couldn't cope. But after talking to Maggie today, I hope you now know that there's nothing shameful about getting professional help. I don't know where I would be if I hadn't had therapists to talk to, especially when my cancer came back. And I loved what she said about self-care. I've never heard it described that way before, but it really resonated with me. What did you think? Keep your comments coming. It's been lovely hearing what you thought about Felicity's episode. And I must admit, I was shocked at the results of the poll that showed over 40% of you have experienced online abuse. We've still got a lot of work to do to make the online space a kinder place. The Jar of Joy continues to grow. Polly said it was having incredible women for friends, and Michelle said it was seeing the primroses on a sunny dog walk. Mine has to be doing yoga with goats. You had to be there, trust me. Next week, I'm coming at mental health from a different angle. I've heard from so many of you who've been through a tough time, like a cancer diagnosis, and you've told me that your husbands have struggled to cope. Next week, I'm going to talk about how we can help men to open up and share their feelings without the stigma of appearing weak. If you enjoyed the show, make sure you subscribe and feel free to drop me a line and let me know what elephants you'd like me to cover next. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back next week.